Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us here on Sunday in the morning on the wake-up call. My name is Rick Moore. With me today, I have Carolyn Englehart. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Rick.
Carolyn is the professor at the UVA School of Medicine in the Department of Public Health Sciences, where she is a health policy analyst.
Right.
Such a title. How do you fit that on a card?
In small letters.
The font, size 8.5.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to talk about the Trump administration and their fight to remove or diminish or restrain Obamacare.
Great. So I'm sure your listeners probably know this, but let me just walk back in time a little bit and give some background. So the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was passed in 2010, but it didn't really roll out for people until 2014, because that's when the Medicaid expansion went forward for states that decided to expand their Medicaid program, and the marketplaces that gave subsidies to buy health insurance for people who didn't get health care at their jobs or who weren't on Medicare or Medicaid. And it was a very politically controversial law. Twice it came before the Supreme Court to try to get rid of it, and twice the Supreme Court upheld it by narrow majorities. And then when Donald Trump was elected in 2016, he campaigned, as did every other Republican, on repealing and replacing Obamacare. And in January of 2017, you had the president and both houses of Congress Republican, and everyone thought it would be repealed. But we all know, we probably remember that scene from that summer with John McCain and the thumbs down, that it proved to be much more difficult to get rid of Obamacare, principally because people actually liked pieces of it, even as they didn't like the law.
Do we know why John McCain gave the thumbs down?
Yes, I think most political analysts say it's not because he loved Obamacare, but he felt like the process, the Senate process, had been in secret. It had not been deliberative. And so what he was objecting to was trying to railroad something through the legislative process as opposed to have a deliberate discourse about it. But of course, it drew a lot of attention and made him a target, even after his death. And so what happened was, after it became clear that congressionally they weren't going to be able to defund the ACA, then the Trump administration, through the Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and through executive action in the Trump administration itself, began to issue rules that would allow for Obamacare to be marginalized. States could potentially offer skimpier plans, bare bones plans that were not allowed under the ACA, that would allow people to buy plans more cheaply, which is what many healthy Americans wanted, but would not protect them from pre-existing condition bans or prescription drug benefits or maternity benefits or mental health benefits. And the idea, and those things came in to be, hopefully to bring cheaper prices, but to chip away at, as I said, the consumer protections. And I think most political analysts think that the midterm elections where the Democrats swept the House of Representatives with 40 seats and now have the majority, was a referendum on health care and wanting to keep those consumer protections. So it's a little bit ironic now in recent history that President Trump wants once again to bring up the discussion about repealing Obamacare.
Again, Sunday morning wake-up call here. Our guest today, Carolyn Engelhardt, she is a professor in UVA School of Medicine, where she is a health policy analyst. Been on the program multiple times to discuss the Affordable Care Act. Today we're talking current events and a little more political aspect. Professor Engelhardt not here to take a political viewpoint, but here to discuss not just the Affordable Care Act in its current state, where we are, here on today's date, but also to discuss ticks of what's happened recently to put forth its fight against Obamacare, not just what you can do with your choices as a family or an individual, as we've talked in the past about the Affordable Care Act. So, Professor Engelhardt, the White House and Professor Trump's decisions in the last couple weeks about wanting to fight again and find the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, unconstitutional. Even some key administrators, my notes show that he had two key cabinet secretaries arguing against him that this wasn't a good decision. I wrote down that he had Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, and his Attorney General William Barr were saying, no, don't be doing this. Why would, because a lot of times he seems to have chosen secretaries or key people key on his staff who say, yes, sir.
Right. So that's a really interesting point. I would say also that Mitch McConnell, majority leader in the Senate, also said it was a bad idea. I think most seasoned politicians know what the midterms were about. And the midterms were about people wanting to keep their health care and interjecting fear that you're going to lose something is not a good political move. Why did President Trump do this? So again, let me just refresh everybody's mind about what's happened as of late. So in 2017, December of 2017, Congress passed the tax reform bill. Now, when I use that word reform, that doesn't mean I think it's better or worse. That's what they call it. But as we all know, and you know, we're all getting ready to pay our taxes if we haven't already, it was a big change. But one of the things that was part of that tax bill was to remove the penalty for not having health insurance, this individual mandate that was part of Obamacare. The piece of Obamacare that was universally detested. There's just something about our American DNA that says government shouldn't force us to buy something. And so even though people liked a lot of what the Affordable Care Act did, they hated that part. And so the Republicans passed it as part of this tax bill, thinking it would give them some political currency going forward. Well, what they didn't think would happen, or maybe they didn't anticipate, is that a group of very conservative attorneys general took that and said, aha, okay, this is the exact rationale for why Chief Justice Roberts said in 2012, the first Supreme Court ruling, why Obamacare was constitutional, because Congress has the ability to tax, and that penalty is a tax. Without that tax, without that penalty, it takes away the stuffing of the Affordable Care Act, thereby making it unconstitutional. So for the third time in history, since 2010, these 20 attorneys general filed a suit saying the ACA was unconstitutional. And the district court in Texas, where they brought it, which is a very conservative judge, agreed with them. Now, what was unusual is that typically an administration defends a law that's already on the books. But in this case, Attorney General Sessions, he was still Attorney General at that point, Trump had not fired him yet, came out and said, we agree with the plaintiffs. We think Obamacare should be unconstitutional, at least that piece of it. We think the other pieces, like ban on pre-existing condition exclusions and staying on your parents' health insurance and no lifetime limits on health care coverage, we think those parts are good, but we don't like that other part, so we're not going to defend it in court, which is unusual. That was the status quo, and it's being appealed now to the appellate level as to its constitutionality. And Trump came out last week on the heels of the positive news he received from the summary of the Mueller report that, in his words, totally exonerated him, which we can agree or disagree with, and basically said, okay, I'm going to shift gears now, and I'm going to tell my Department of Justice that not only do we want to fight Obamacare, we want to say the whole law is unconstitutional, not just that one little piece. We want to say the whole law is unconstitutional because this gives us a chance to repeal it again. And his experts were just pulling their hair out. Secretary Azar and his Attorney General, Bill Barr, because they knew that it is could be political suicide. So why did he do it? I read the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. What those writers tell me is that Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, who was a Tea Partier congressman and who hated Obamacare and hates big government programs, got the president's ear and said, you ran on this as a campaign promise. Now that you've gotten through Mueller, apparently, it's time to go into 2020 election mode, and this is a campaign promise you haven't kept, and I think there's some political capital to be gained by going after it again.
Again, we are talking about the Trump administration fighting Obamacare more recently with our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt from UVA's School of Medicine. Just about 13 minutes after the hour here. So the Republican Party, the GOP, had originally started completely against the Affordable Care Act back in 2008, correct?
Yeah. But, well, it wasn't. Remember, 2008 is when Obama was elected. The law wasn't passed till 2010. It took him 2 years to get, not quite 2 years. He was inaugurated in January 2009, and the ACA was passed in late March of 2010. So, but yes, Obamacare ran on health care reform or health care expansion, and the Republicans were against it.
But from the very beginning,
yes.
Well, I probably won't remember to get my years correct. But from the very beginning, the Republican Party was against the Affordable Care Act. But now they have accepted it in a variety of ways, except, as you say, the Tea Party end side of the GOP. But why is that?
Why have they accepted it?
Or, yes.
Or
Is it because they lost and they've given up? Or is it because they've recognized that a fairly significant percentage of the Americans want this?
I think,
or something in between.
Yeah, I think the latter. I think that any student of health policy and health politics would tell you that it's much more difficult to take an entitlement away than to give it. And that once you've given it, loathe be the political candidate that wants to run against taking it away.
Loathe be.
Yeah. So that is just a fact of life. Economists will tell you that loss aversion, the fear of giving something up you have, is greater than the promise of a better tomorrow. So that's what the 2018 midterms were all about. I mean, people in this country are choking because healthcare is so expensive. One out of four Americans did not access needed healthcare last year because they couldn't afford it. And these were people who have insurance. It's just so expensive. The number one issue going into the 2018 midterms was the cost of prescription drugs, and by extension, the cost of healthcare overall. So there is this problem that people feel acutely, and the Republicans know that. And if they run against taking away something that tends to protect people that they've gotten used to having, it's not going to work.
I'm sure if it's not you personally or me personally, we won't have to take that six connections. It's you can probably find the next person before you get to the story of the expense of the health cost. So I can understand that you don't want to give up something that is saving you any money, whether it's, you know, we all have a prescription or some sort of purchase for even if it's a prescription drug or getting the antibiotic. Or you look at it, oh, I only paid $15 for it, but here's what you would have paid for it if you didn't have a health insurance.
Right.
And it's $15. Oh, it would have been $200. Or here's your prescription and you're paying $60, but it would have been, you know, $725. And if you look closely at those, you go, good grief. Right. How is that even possible?
Right.
You know, and I have one where I pay, and excuse me for getting personal here, but I have one that I pay $200 for, and it's $5,000 and something. And I'm just like, what?
Right, right. And that's an interesting point, because that actually is a bipartisan issue that could, you could actually see politicians working across the aisle. I mean, it's a equal employment problem. It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. Prescription drug pricing and how they're priced and how expensive they are, it hits everyone. Another one that's gotten a lot of attention recently is surprise medical bills. I mean, again and again and again, you hear stories of people who go to the hospital, their hospital's in network, their surgeon's in network, but they're surprised their anesthesiologist wasn't, and they get huge medical bills.
We're going to take our first break, because when we come back, I have I want to continue with this to fold into some of the issues that that President Trump wants to eliminate Obamacare, but things that he wants to keep that seem to bump heads with one another. He wants to eliminate HIV in the U.S. He wants to contain the opioid crisis. He wants to lower the cost of prescription drugs. But he needs to keep Obamacare to keep those promises together. And I want to hear from Professor Engelhardt, how those can be kept working. So hang tight, folks. We shall return here to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. All right. Thanks for being with us here today. As a reminder, if you weren't listening, weren't watching TV last night, UVA championship game. Way to go, men's basketball. And while...
Watch tomorrow night. That'll be the final.
Yeah, watch tomorrow. That will be a final. Be supportive. I'm a college basketball fan, if you can't tell.
I've got on orange shoes.
That's the way to support. I had on my lucky socks last night. We won't be washing those before tomorrow. I'll just be wearing those again. So, again, Professor Engelhardt with us today. Professor at UVA School of Medicine, Department of Public Health Sciences, where she is the health policy analyst. We're talking about the Trump administration fighting Obamacare. And you remind us, this is the third time that they'll be going to making their supreme strong effort.
Right. So the Texas judge that heard the case that said that the ACA, Obamacare, is unconstitutional because the penalty for the individual mandate was eliminated, is a very conservative judge. People bring lawsuits to certain courts often because they know the judge there might be disposed to their way of thinking. Most political experts, legal experts that I've read, believe that at the appellate level, the lawsuit will not go forward. But who knows? It's going to be in a New Orleans appellate level, and it's a very conservative panel. But there are lots of legal pieces of this lawsuit that I don't understand. I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand well, but there seems to be several areas that the defendants, that is, those defending the ACA, think they will prevail. If they do, and the appellate level disagrees with the district level, then the conservative attorneys general that brought the case can then ask the Supreme Court to hear it for the third time. Would mean the third time that the ACA would go before the Supreme Court. People think that will take probably a year. So it could happen right before the presidential election. That could influence it. And you can imagine the posturing on both sides that President Trump would campaign on finally being able to overturn the ACA through the courts because they couldn't do it legislatively. And the Democratic challenger, whoever that is, the field seems to be growing every day, would campaign on taking people's health care away. People don't realize what the ACA is. If you take away the ACA, it's not just taking away insurance from 20 million people, although that would happen overnight. But it also means that parents could no longer keep their children on their health insurance plans till they were 26. It also means that some of the changes in the Medicare program that helps senior citizens afford prescription drugs in the donut hole, that would go away. It touches a lot of things other than just buying health insurance on the marketplace for those 11 million people and the people getting Medicaid expansion, which is about another 11 million. So I don't think people really understand the breadth of eliminating this law and all the different things it touches. But that would be the political conversation. And personally, as someone who has studied this for 30 years, I will say that I think the Republicans would be courting disaster to campaign on taking this away.
Well, isn't this why Senator McConnell, we'll use him as the example, isn't excited and that's the word I'll use, by President Trump putting this forward?
Absolutely. He knows that's what the midterms were all about. And it's really easy to make sound bites into things like taking your health care away, making you pay more if you have a health condition. I mean, people over the age of 65, granted, they're on Medicare, but they have an average number of 5 prescriptions. They often see 9 different doctors. We are a society of chronically ill individuals. 75% of the $3.7 trillion we spend every year has to do with managing well or not so well chronic care. So we are a nation of people who have medical problems. And the thought that somehow their insurance is going to be unavailable or more expensive because they have heart disease or diabetes or hypertension, or their children do, is just, that's over. Nobody's going to accept that anymore.
Again, our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhard from UVA, as we talk about the health policy. She is the health policy analyst as we talk about the Trump administration fighting Obamacare. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the Trump White House continues to talk about some of their goals. They want to eliminate HIV in the United States. They want to contain the opioid crisis. And they want to lower the cost of prescription drugs, one of the things that we've just been discussing. And some of the articles that I've read about the Affordable Care Act say that all of those need Obamacare to be successful. Is that true?
Yeah, it's sort of a disconnect, isn't it? Doesn't have to be. You can certainly provide programs outside of the ACA, but right now the reality is that the medication-assisted treatment programs for the opioid epidemic, alongside counseling, which most mental health substance abuse experts agree is the only way to get people off of opioids. Opioids change your brain chemistry. You know, people, once you become addicted, you don't take it anymore to get high. You take it to function. There was part of the book, Festival of the Book, I moderated a panel on this topic, and one of the books was Beth Macy's Dope Sick. And that term, dope sick, has to do with what happens when you go into withdrawal and the vomiting and the diarrhea and almost the seizures. I mean, it is so incredibly physically, it's painful. And so you don't keep taking drugs to get high. You take them simply to not be very, very sick. So most experts believe that the way to effective recovery is through a combination of going on medication like methadone and other kinds of drugs that quell those side effects but don't make you high, and having counseling. Those are offered through Medicaid. So the adults now that have been covered in states that have expanded their Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act now have those services available to them. And if Obamacare went away, those services would potentially go away unless there was a new funding stream that provided that to people through other kinds of insurance. Right now, private insurance covers that sometimes, but not universally. HIV is another example where you get HIV treatment, pharmaceuticals, through Medicaid. But also, and there's a big research effort at UVA, Kate McManus, Professor McManus, has done work on this, and I've been on her advisory board for years, where they've done kind of an experiment where they allow HIV individuals to get a subsidy and buy health insurance on the exchange. And they find that that helps patients manage their HIV. So if Obamacare went away, it would hurt both of those populations, because services that aid in that recovery would at least go away in the short term until other revenue streams were found to subsidize them. Now, I will say that I think what we've seen again and again is that President Trump says things because his advisors tell him to say things, or his speechwriters put things in his speeches. But I don't really think President Trump understands how our health system works. Remember, he said you needed an ID to go grocery shopping. And when people called him on that, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders admitted that, well, no, President Trump really probably has never gone to the grocery store by himself. You know, he's always had people buying groceries on his behalf. And so all politicians rely on experts, and that's why there are experts, to help them define policy areas. But saying you're going to make something a national priority and then cutting the legs out from under it in the programs that are currently servicing that priority doesn't make a lot of sense.
Our guest today, our expert, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt here from UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences. Do we know why, though? Is this, do we think, because obviously, as we discussed, you can't get inside President Trump's brain. Is this, if the goal is to lower the cost of prescription drugs, one of the goals, and we already have Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, keeping the prescription costs low, is there a way to get them lower, remove Affordable Care Act, and then install some other legislative act to do that?
Well, yes. The ACA didn't necessarily make prescription drugs cost lower. They made prescription drugs more accessible to certain individuals who didn't have insurance before through private insurance. But
so it made them lower for some people.
Right. Who maybe in the past didn't have insurance at all and didn't, you know, had to pay full price at the pharmacy to get prescription drugs. Prescription drugs are incredibly expensive. The last 12 cancer blockbuster drugs cost more than $100,000 a year to take. We have something in medicine now called precision medicine, which is wonderful, which basically will help inform us why a certain drug works for you but doesn't work for me, and we have the same diagnosis because of our different genetic makeup. Those sorts of things will drive medical discovery and help us stay healthy, but they're very expensive. So the two things are connected, but they're different. And there are lots of things that the FDA can do. I would remind your listeners that both political candidates during the last presidential election, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, campaigned on allowing Medicare to negotiate directly with the pharmaceutical industry on the price of drugs. This is what other developed countries do. Another name for this is price controls. The pharmaceutical industry says if the government exerts price controls, they will not be able to invest money in research and development and keep new drugs coming to the market. But the exchange for that is the continuation of very expensive drugs. Once President Trump was elected, he backed off on that promise. I don't know what Clinton would have done had she been elected. The pharmaceutical industry is an unbelievably powerful stakeholder in our political system. And most Americans believe, or I mean, they don't want to pay high prices, but you hold little Johnny up and somebody says, without the R&D that goes into our, you know, drug research mechanism, little Johnny's not going to get the medicine he needs to get well. And most people, we call this the identifiable victim strategy. And most people go for that. And they would rather not have government price controls because they want the hope that little Johnny will be cured. But in exchange for that, you get a pharmaceutical industry that can name their price. And for many now, it's become kind of on to the breaking point. But there are things that can be done beyond price controls that, again, could be bipartisan. We could accelerate generics to the market so that there are brand name drugs cost something like 400 times more than generics. I mean, it's a huge difference. So we could get generics out faster. Right now, some pharmaceutical industries refuse to give parts of their drugs to the generic industry so they can begin working on generics. There's a name for that, but I don't remember what it is. The federal government could regulate that after a certain period of time, based on patent life, they have to release those formulas, those chemicals, whatever it is, so that generics can be made more easily. It's also something called evergreening, and that's when the pharmaceutical industry takes their very popular patented drug, and as it's going off patent, changes it just slightly and repatents it. And that then extends the patent again, which means generics can't go forward. Those sorts of things could be done without price controls. That's what Scott Gottlieb, who just stepped down as the head of the FDA, was trying to work on and get through. He's a Republican. He's a very conservative. He's a physician. But I think both Democrats and Republicans thought he did a super job and was going in the right direction. So those are things that could be done on a bipartisan basis. I think that would make Americans, less cynical about our government right now.
Let's talk a bit about that Texas court case that is being brought forward to try and determine the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. This is what the Trump administration is hoping for.
Right.
How many people would lose their insurance if this happens?
20 million.
20 million.
And that doesn't include the 26 and unders who currently get it from their parents. It would be those as well. I think that's usually between 3 and 6 million people at any given time.
And how would the current insurance market react? I mean, would that take my insurance, which I would be able to keep, assumingly, through my employer? Would my insurance go up? Would my insurance go down? Would I lose the range of my insurance? Can you tell me anything about the expectations of that?
Well, if you want to know what it would look like, you have to go back to what your insurance was like in 2009, because that's what it would be. Large companies had good insurance and smaller companies didn't.
All right, let's take another quick break and come back. I want to cover a little bit more of that. Again, our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt from UVA. At the UVA School of Medicine, where she is a health policy analyst. Hang tight. All right, back with our guest, Professor Carolyn Engelhardt, as we talk about the Trump administration and their push to find the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, unconstitutional, that has started or regained itself with a court case in Texas. Professor, I had asked what the insurance market might look like if this actually takes place. It goes to the Supreme Court, and because I think we all know that that's where it's going to end up. Whoever wins in Texas, or then you said it's going to go to
The appellate level in New Orleans.
New Orleans. whoever wins and loses there, it's going to end up in the Supreme Court, correct?
Right.
But whatever the outcome is, if the Affordable Care Act is found eventually to be unconstitutional and the 20-plus million lose their health insurance, I'm curious how the insurance market reacts and what my insurance will look like. You said to take it back to what it looked like before 2010.
Right.
Well,
right.
I don't remember. My memory is shot. I lost a lot of my behavior as a college student. My you know, brain cells pop like soap bubbles all the time.
Well, and that's a really good observation because, as I said before, people get used to having things a certain way, and they may not remember what it was like before. Maybe they were on their parents' insurance before. Maybe they were healthier. 30-year-olds are now 40. 40-year-olds are now 50. So let's look at how the insurance industry worked before the Affordable Care Act. If you worked for a large company, say over 250 employees, you usually didn't get charged more if you had a pre-existing condition. You had what was called community rating. There were enough employees to absorb the risk of those who were sick, because most of the time workers are pretty healthy, a pretty healthy cohort. When the Affordable Care Act came in, it came in to really provide insurance protections for certain groups of people. One were individuals who didn't get insurance at their jobs and had to buy it on the open market. And at that time, I think there were maybe 18 million people in that category. And it regulated insurance mostly for small businesses who may have offered very bare bones plans. So maybe offered plans that didn't have prescription drugs or mental health or maternity. And basically the ACA said, every private insurance product, wherever it is going to have to offer comprehensive health insurance. It's going to have to offer prescription drugs, mental health, rehab, rehabilitation, inpatient, outpatient, maternity. And that meant, of course, if you offer those benefits, the premium is going to go up. It's expensive to offer benefits. And so for some people, it meant that their insurance became more expensive, but they were protected. And because employers and employees get tax benefits when they buy health insurance, they can pay for their premiums in pre-tax dollars, which lowers their taxable income. This is the point at which my students' eyes glaze over, so I'm not going to go into that unless you want me to. But it meant that the individuals who went to the market to buy health insurance before the ACA, who were disproportionately sick, older, females were charged more than men before the ACA because women use more health services during their reproductive years, and men use more health services when they get older because of cardiovascular disease, typically. All of those things were regulated such that insurance companies couldn't charge me more than you or couldn't not cover people because they had diabetes or hypertension. Insurers had to take all comers, and they couldn't drop you if you were sick. And in exchange, the Affordable Care Act promised insurers that they would get healthy people to offset sick people in the insurance pools through the individual mandate.
Right. That was the requirement of everybody has to have this.
And that was the penalty that was eliminated in December 2017, which was the genesis of the latest lawsuit challenging the constitutionality. So if we go back, it would mean that absent other reforms, people who were sicker could be charged more or not offered insurance at all. Older people would be charged up to 7 times more than younger people. Under the ACA, that capped it at 3 times more. It would mean that women would be charged more than men. It means that women might buy a health insurance product. Say I'm a freelance worker. Say I run my own business and I have to buy insurance as a single, or a married, whatever, as a woman. And I'm of reproductive age and I get an insurance policy, and that insurance policy could tell me, okay, we either aren't going to offer maternity benefits at all, or you have a 12-month waiting period, because we don't want to offer you insurance if you're pregnant, because we know you're going to use a lot of stuff right off the bat. Those are the kinds of things that were in place before the ACA and the ACA got rid of, that most Americans appreciate, but now they may have forgotten because they've gotten used to having it. But I can tell you that the discourse, the political discourse, will be, you know, dread. On the Democrats will campaign on taking health care away. Now, there are people who are unhappy with the Affordable Care Act because it made health insurance more expensive. These are the individuals who are young and healthy. And before the ACA, they could buy a bare bones, high deductible, catastrophic plan for $50 a month. Under the ACA, which now has to include all those bells and whistles I just mentioned, the cheapest product now is about $500 a month. So those are the folks who are unhappy and may want to support the Trump administration's movement to offering alternative products. But it's health insurance 101. You take the healthy people out of the pool and insurance gets more expensive, or the insurance pool that's left is filled only with sick people, which means it will implode. It can't work.
Right. You have to bring in more money. And I mean, they're businesses, so they have to bring in more money, enough money to pay out. They're not.
Yeah. If you had homeowners,
they're not nonprofits.
No. And if you had homeowners insurance and the only people in your insurance pool were people who lived in floodplains, how would that work?
Right. But we're talking of, you've mentioned several times about the upcoming elections. Let's talk about that for a few moments. When the elections are coming up, there are a number of folks in the Democratic side of things, the Democrats, I should say, they're all hopefully Democratic, the Democrats who are mentioning Medicare for All.
Right.
Which is, as I say, Democratic. Medicare for All will be pushed by some as socialist.
Right.
So talk about that.
Right. So just as I said that I think running against Obamacare is politically risky for Republicans, I think running on Medicare for All is politically naive for Democrats. And I say that because 150 million Americans get health insurance through their jobs. That is the biggest piece of how people get health coverage. Private health coverage is through their jobs. Medicare for All, in the most basic sense of it, would eliminate private health insurance. Many people who have private health insurance through their jobs are quite happy with it. We all like to complain about premiums being too high and prescription drugs being too high, but most of us enjoy the benefits, the tax benefits that come with getting it at your workplace. And the fact that healthcare is so complicated, we like knowing that there's some poor soul or souls in human resources who are making decisions on our best behalf because they understand how health insurance works. To take that away with Medicare for All and opening up the Republican criticism that everybody's taxes are going to go up and that you might not be able to choose your doctor anymore and you might not be able to have access to certain expensive drugs or whatever other scare tactics they will bring out, would be devastating. And I think it would be a gift to Republicans. I think a wiser move on the part of the Democrats is to either do what Speaker Pelosi has unveiled, which is to fix some of the problems in the Affordable Care Act, provide subsidies more into the middle class area so those folks now who are paying full freight and find it too expensive can get some help in buying health insurance in the individual market, providing different kinds of reinsurance mechanisms to make insurance premiums more stable. Those are the things that the architects of the ACA had hoped would be part of the evolution, but didn't happen because the Trump administration came in and because, quite frankly, conservatives and Republicans think that big government programs are bad. And that's an ideological perspective. It doesn't mean it's a bad perspective. So I think tinkering at the edges, either in that way or doing what Senator Kaine and some others have suggested, which is to allow people like 50 years old and older to buy into Medicare, would be a better way of bringing people into the existing system instead of getting rid of the existing system and putting, as Bernie Sanders would have us, just Medicare for all.
Can I quote something you sent me in an email that I think is appropriate? You say, people can't even share a cup of coffee in this political environment, so it's difficult to imagine a bipartisan fix to the Affordable Care Act making it through Congress.
Right. Yeah, that is true. Although, I will say, as I said earlier, there are certain issues, not big issues like Medicare for All, but smaller issues like surprise medical bills, trying to regulate that. That is something that is a bipartisan issue. Or some prescription drug reform. That's a bipartisan issue. But it is the climate out there is so bad and so sad. I mean, there are articles every day about how neighbors don't talk to each other. Parents don't want their children to date people from the other party. The amount of vitriol and lack of civility and name calling is, I think we're in a sad point in our country. And I think, you know, Trump has taught us to react based on fear that the immigrants are coming in and taking over, fear that the government's going to take something away. Obama, you know, got people together based on hope. I don't know what the message will be for 2020, but if I had a magic wand, I would just start by making people kinder and more compassionate to each other.
11:54 here, a few minutes left with our guest today, Professor Carolyn Engelhard from UVA's School of Medicine, where she is a health policy analyst, as we're talking about the Trump administration fighting against Obamacare. You talked about surprise medical bills in that last comment. One of the things that I've always found problematic when you listen to the news, NPR, is people talking about how they, you know, one hospital charges $5,000 for this surgery and another hospital charges $25,000 for this surgery. Is there anything like that in Affordable Care Act or discussion about a change possibly?
No, but I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of health policy experts now are moving towards the idea of having some sort of fee schedule so that you can compensate for this variation. The reason we have this variation is because in certain markets, hospitals have market leverage, and in some areas, insurers have market leverage. When hospitals have market leverage, they can name their price. If you're an academic health center everybody wants to go to, if you're the Mayo Clinic, if you're, you know, then, you know, insurers will pay what they have to pay. Patients never see that, and the hospitals say that, but you've got all these disparate prices, and it just makes it less transparent patients pull their hair out. Nobody knows how much an MRI costs. Nobody knows how much anything costs. And it makes it really hard. So one of the beauties of Medicare for All, if we ever went down that road, is that we would take all that administrative cost out. Insurance companies now, you know, there's many of them, and they have different forms. And under a system, an overall system, there would be fees. So, you know, it might be Medicare plus 40%. But you would know that. It would be the same for everybody. Maybe if you lived in New York City, it would be more expensive than in Des Moines, Iowa. But it would be simplistic, administratively much simpler. And that is a big issue people are talking about, is this cost variation and this lack of transparency about what things cost at all.
All right. Just another minute or two. One of the last things, President Trump mentioned how the GOP will be the party. I forget what phrase he used. The Republican Party will soon be known as the party of health care. But again, finding the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional, but they've yet to present their own health care. Do we have any idea of what the GOP's health plan would be?
Well, so see, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, as soon as he said that, everybody distanced themselves from it because there was no plan. On the talk shows this morning, a little bit, I mean, listened a little bit. I think some themes are coalescing, and I think that what those themes are would be to give states more power to fine tune their own health care plans within their state, which would mean that states could have different plans or different insurance regulation. I don't think that's going to protect consumers the way the ACA did, but it might have at least a plan that Republicans can run on.
All right, last question. We know that this will probably end up at the Supreme Court. With the current justices, do you see how this might end up?
I'm not a legal expert, but I can only think that Chief Justice Roberts twice voted to keep the ACA, and I can't help but think he would want that to happen again.
Okay. Again, our guest, Carolyn Engelhardt, she is a professor at the UVA School of Medicine in the Department of Public Health Sciences, where she is a health policy analyst. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We will have this on a website. What, Dan, why can't I think of the website?
CEOpodcast.com.
I don't know why that escaped me at the last minute.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and I hope your listeners will be engaged, and I encourage everyone to vote.
Thank you so much. Take care, everybody. See you next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.